From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Presidential campaign ads don't have catchy jingles anymore, but Eisenhower's did. He was the first presidential candidate to have ads on TV. On this President's Day, we listen back to some of the earliest and most influential presidential campaign ads. Our guest David Schwartz co-curated an exhibition of presidential campaign ads for the American Museum of the Moving Image. Also, how Abe Lincoln turned his political rivals into allies and cabinet members. We talk with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin about her book, Team of Rivals. She's just been awarded the 16th annual Lincoln Prize for the book. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this President's Day, I have a question for you. Who was the first president to run campaign ads on TV? The answer is Eisenhower. What did they sound like? You're about to hear a couple, along with several other influential presidential campaign ads from the past few decades. The American Museum of the Moving Image in New York has an internet exhibition called The Living Room Candidate, which is a history of presidential campaign ads. It features over 250 ads from every election year, beginning in 1952, when the first TV campaign ads were broadcast. The exhibition is on the internet at the website livingroomcandidate.movingimage.us. It will be updated to include ads from the 2008 campaign. My guest, David Schwartz, is the museum's curator of film, and he's the co-curator of The Living Room Candidate. I spoke with him in 2004 when the exhibition was launched and asked him to describe the first presidential campaign ad broadcast on TV.
The first televised ads for a presidential campaign were used by Eisenhower in 1952, and it was a really innovative idea at the time. In 1948, there were television sets in only a few hundred thousand households around the country. By 1952, there were about 20 million TV sets, and I Love Lucy was a big hit on TV, so it made television very popular. And the Eisenhower campaign had a strategy, which was to buy short spots of time between popular TV shows. So and they would do commercials that were only 20 seconds long. These were the original sound bites. They did a series of commercials with Eisenhower on camera answering questions from ordinary people. Now, the Stevenson campaign felt that television was undignified, and Stevenson, Adlai Stevenson, did not appear in his own television commercials that year because he felt it was beneath the dignity of a presidential candidate to be on TV in a spot ad.
Well, let's hear one of the first presidential campaign ads, and this was for Eisenhower in 1952. The ad is basically a jingle with a cartoon behind it. Would you describe what's happening in this cartoon?
This cartoon was actually made by the Walt Disney Studio, and you're seeing a parade of people marching towards Washington. And it's animated. It's an old-fashioned cartoon.
And they're all carrying signs that say Eisenhower for president, and I like Ike,
right,
and things like
Ike.
That.
Yeah. That's right.
Okay, so let's hear this 1952 campaign ad for Eisenhower.
Ike for president, Ike for president, Ike for president, Ike for president. You like Ike, I like Ike. Everybody likes Ike for president. Hang out the banner, beat the drum. We'll take Ike to Washington.
We don't want John
or Dean
or Harry.
Let's do that big job right. Just get in step with the guy that's hep. Get in step with Ike. You like Ike, I like Ike. Everybody likes Ike for president. Hang out the banner, beat the drum. We'll take Ike to Washington. We got to get where we are going. Travel day and night
for president.
Let Adelaide go the other way. We'll all go with Ike. You like Ike, I like Ike.
President.
Hang out the banner, beat the drum. We'll take Ike to Washington. We'll take Ike to Washington.
Now is the time for all good Americans to come to the aid of their country. Vote for Eisenhower.
Wow. It's really the jingle era, isn't it?
And that is catchy, yeah.
Truth in Advertising, was Ike really a guy that's hep?
Well, Ike was a guy that was very well-liked, and it was really his personality and his likability that fueled his campaign. In 1952, both parties, both the Democratic and Republican parties, wanted Ike to run in their ticket, and he chose the Republican Party. But what this commercial really is selling largely is a combination of Ike's personality, and there was a lot of disillusionment with Washington. Harry Truman had decided not to run for re-election this year. The country was stuck in the Korean War. There were corruption scandals in Washington. So there was a real anti-Washington feeling that year, and Ike was able to cash in on that.
Whose idea was it to do a campaign ad in the Eisenhower, in the Eisenhower campaign crew?
It was Madison Avenue's idea. There was an advertising man named Rosser Reeves, his earlier claim to fame was the M&M melts in your mouth, not in your hands campaign. And it was really his strategy to produce these 20-second ads. He thought they would be very effective. He thought they could reach a lot of people. The Stevenson campaign made a very interesting choice, and it was a big mistake that year with their TV strategy. They purchased half-hour time slots, a series of 18 time slots between 10:30 and 11 o'clock at night, where Stevenson would go on the air and do speeches, half-hour speeches. Now, it sounded like a good idea at the time, and he was a very good speaker, had great oratorical skills. The problem was that the only people who were really tuning in to watch these half-hour speeches were people who already were going to vote for Stevenson. The strategy with the Eisenhower spot ads was they could go on to popular TV shows like I Love Lucy and catch a captive audience that was already there.
Let's listen to another Eisenhower ad, also from 1952, in which a woman expresses her concern about high prices. Before we actually hear this ad, set it up for us. What's happening visually?
Each of these ads, this is the Eisenhower Answers America spot, consists of two shots. The first shot in the ad, and I think of these commercials as short movies, and this is a very short movie. You see an ordinary person, you know, in this case, a woman is concerned about the high cost of living, high prices. And they ask a question of Eisenhower. And the person who's asking the question is filmed from above, the camera sort of looking down at them. And then we cut to Eisenhower. And in those shots, the camera is looking up at Eisenhower, so he looks kind of heroic. And he answers the question of the ordinary person. So he's connecting with the voter.
Okay, so here we are, an ad for the Eisenhower campaign in 1952.
Eisenhower Answers America.
You know what things cost today. High prices are just driving me crazy.
Yes, my Mamie gets after me about the high cost of living. It's another reason why I say it's time for a change. Time to get back to an honest dollar and an honest dollar's worth.
A couple of things I find really interesting about that 1952 Eisenhower ad. One is that they both absolutely sound like they're reading the script for the first time. They're not very good at acting the part of being themselves.
No. Well, they filmed about 40 of these commercials in one day. They basically took Eisenhower into a studio in Midtown Manhattan and set him up in front of a bunch of gigantic cue cards where they had the scripts. And Eisenhower was a little bit uncomfortable doing this. At one point, probably about halfway through the session, he said, "It's kind of a shame that an old soldier should have to come to this." And he was just reading these answers off of big cue cards. And he was a little bit stiff, perhaps, but probably not as stiff as Stevenson came across in his TV appearances. But the commercials look kind of crude. Eisenhower's answers were filmed separately from these ordinary people who were rounded up in front of Radio City Music Hall and brought in after Eisenhower's answers were filmed.
Oh, wow.
Ordinary people were brought in to ask their questions.
The other thing about this ad is that it sounds so condescending to women now. It's like, you know, the woman complains about high prices and Eisenhower basically says, "I've never made a purchase in my life, but there's a woman in my home. She's my wife. She shopped and she's told me that prices are high." You know, that's how it kind of comes off.
Well, it was 1952.
I know.
Those were the rules of the time. And Eisenhower did try to reach women voters, actually, in both 52 and 56. There was a growing suburban population and sort of an increasing importance of the housewife, you know, at the time, as a voting bloc. So this was Eisenhower's pitch to the woman voter. But also, the Eisenhower campaign identified three key issues to focus on. One was high prices, another one was the war in Korea, and then there was corruption in Washington. And these ads keep hitting on these three key issues.
So was this, you know, quote, ordinary people ad effective?
It's hard to say if this ad was determinative in the election. Eisenhower would have won this election almost under any circumstances. It was a landslide election. But I think it was effective because the Eisenhower campaign spent about $1 million putting their ads on TV, or actually close to $2 million. The Stevenson campaign only spent about $77,000 in TV ads that year. In 1956, when it was a rematch of Eisenhower versus Stevenson, Stevenson decided to do his own series of ads called The Man from Libertyville, and he appeared on television. So after 1952, it was evident that candidates would have to do these commercials and style themselves as TV stars, even though they were reluctant, even though Stevenson and Eisenhower both were kind of reluctant to become TV actors, they realized they had to do it.
Now, Kennedy was John F. Kennedy was very telegenic. Mm. What were his TV ads like?
John Kennedy's TV ads really reflected the spontaneity and freshness of his campaign. He was great on television. Of course, it's very well known that the debates, that he looked much better than Richard Nixon in the debates. He was a lot fresher and more spontaneous. And the spontaneity of the campaign was captured by documentary film cameras. At the time, in 1960, filmmakers were starting to use lightweight portable cameras. And often, Kennedy's campaign appearances were filmed. Cameras would follow him follow him around making speeches, follow him into people's living rooms. There's one ad that we have on our site, which is Kennedy in an ordinary living room talking to average voters. It's really the personality and freshness of the Kennedy campaign came across in his TV ads.
This is the Sills family. Recently, John F. Kennedy visited the Sills.
Mr. and Mrs. Sills are facing one of the great problems that all American families are now facing. And that is the great increase in the cost of living.
Our rent has gone up, our food, our cleaning of our clothing, buying of the clothing, our gas and electric, and our telephone bills have gone up.
What's been your experience, Mr. Sills, as far as keeping those two daughters of yours going?
Well, we're very concerned with their future. We would like both of them to go to college.
Have you been able to put much aside as far as...
No, unfortunately, not right now.
One of the things which I think has increased the cost of living has been this administration's reliance upon a high-interest rate policy. My own judgment is that we're going to have to try to do a better job in this field.
Yes, we can do better. But to do so, we must elect the man who cares about America's problems. We must elect John F. Kennedy, president.
That's a TV ad from the Kennedy campaign in 1960. The ad is part of an exhibit of presidential campaign ads called The Living Room Candidate on the website of the American Museum of the Moving Image. My guest, David Schwartz, is the co-curator of the exhibit. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with David Schwartz, co-curator of an exhibit of presidential campaign ads dating back to 1952. It's on the website of the American Museum of the Moving Image. Let's skip ahead to a 1964 ad from the Johnson campaign against Barry Goldwater. Now, it's very famous, but it was only run once as a paid political ad. Would you describe what's happening visually in this ad, and then we'll play the audio?
The visuals are, again, two very simple shots that are juxtaposed. The ad starts off with an image of a young girl who looks like she's 5 or 6 years old, and she's in a field picking petals off of a daisy and counting up to 10. And that's the first shot. And as she approaches 10, the camera zooming in, and it closes in on her eye. And then we start to hear an ominous voice, a countdown to a nuclear explosion. And the ad actually ends with an image of a huge mushroom cloud and a nuclear explosion.
Okay, let's hear the audio from this 1964 ad by the LBJ campaign.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
These are the stakes. To make a world in which all of God's children can live, or to go into the dark. We must either love each other, or we must die.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
It's probably the first and the last time that nuclear apocalypse was used in a campaign ad. Why was this ad taken off the air after one run?
Well, this was a very effective ad because it really played on the fear that Barry Goldwater could get us into a nuclear war. Now, supposedly, Johnson was reluctant to run this ad. It was pretty over the top in a way because what it was saying was that if you vote for Barry Goldwater, the world could come to an end. I mean, that's pretty extreme even for an attack ad. And it was controversial. As soon as the ad aired, it was shown during a movie of the week broadcast of the movie David and Bathsheba. As soon as it aired, the switchboards lit up at the White House and also at the network, and there were a lot of complaints from the Goldwater campaign that this ad was just unfair. Now, what's interesting is that Barry Goldwater's name is never even mentioned in the ad, but the public really knew that he had made some extreme statements at the convention that year. He said that extremism and the defense of liberty is no vice, and he had advocated the possible use of nuclear weapons in Vietnam, tactical nuclear weapons. So this ad really played into that fear. This was the year of Dr. Strangelove also, and a lot of times what you'll find is that the commercials reflect other things going on in the culture at that time. So the country was afraid of nuclear war. But the Johnson campaign tried this ad out, and they had a lot of other attack ads that they had also made, and their idea was to just run this one time. They thought that if you ran an ad too many times, the audience might get bored with it. They wanted to keep trying out different ads. But what happened was the ad instantly went from a paid advertisement to a major news story. So as soon as the Goldwater campaign complained about it, the network news broadcast started replaying the ad and talking about it. And so the Johnson campaign didn't have to pay for it anymore to be on the air. It became a news story.
Oh, is that why they never ran it again? Not because it was controversial, but because it was getting played for free as a news story?
Sure, it was getting free play all over the airwaves. Everybody was talking about the ad, and the networks were rebroadcasting it for free. So why should the Johnson campaign, you know, pay to put it on again? And they had other campaign ads that were not quite as strong as that, but were strong attack ads, and they were running those other ads as well.
What was the common wisdom about the lessons of this controversial nuclear war ad?
Well, I think the lesson from this ad was that attack ads can be very effective because we saw Humphrey and Nixon in 1968 do very strong attack ads. The ad really did two things that really worked at an emotional level. And I think ultimately if an ad is going to be effective, it has to work on an emotional level. One thing it did was evoke fear. Fear of the end of the world, but also fear that this little girl would be hurt, who you see. And then the other thing that the ad did was use children, use an image of a child. And I think children really touch a deep emotional chord. And children can be used in ads for a lot of different purposes. They can evoke fear, they can create a kind of warmth, an image of warmth for the candidate. And then children can also represent the future. They can represent hope in the future. So we start to see children in a lot of ads.
Let's move on to an ad from 1980 for the Reagan campaign against the incumbent Jimmy Carter. And I was really surprised to see this ad. I don't remember this one from television, but it's an ad featuring Nancy Reagan sitting in a chair and talking. Describe what's happening visually in this ad, and then we'll play it.
Well, we see Nancy Reagan. She's dressed in red. She looks like a conventional image of a candidate's spouse, a potential first lady in this case. And she's just talking directly to the camera. So we seem to be being set up for a sort of upbeat, positive ad where we're going to hear from the candidate's wife, maybe about how great her husband is.
Okay, here's Nancy Reagan in 1980.
I deeply, deeply resent and am offended by the attacks that President Carter's made on my husband, the personal attacks that he's made on my husband, his attempt to paint my husband as a man he is not. He is not a warmonger. He is not a man who is going to throw the elderly out on the street and cut out their Social Security. That's a terrible thing to do and to say about anybody. That's campaigning on fear. There are many issues that are at stake in this campaign. I would like Mr. Carter to explain to me why the inflation is as high as it is, why unemployment is as high as it is. I would like to have him explain the vacillating, weak foreign policy so that our friends overseas don't know what we're going to do, whether we're going to stand up for them or whether we're not going to stand up for them. And the issue of this campaign is his 3.5-year record.
The time is now for strong leadership.
It's Nancy Reagan in 1980, a campaign ad for her husband. Did she have to be convinced to do this ad? Do you know?
Oh, I don't know. I think that Nancy Reagan was quite happy to be a, I guess you could say, an attack dog for her husband. She was very strong and outspoken. And the idea of the 1980 campaign was to let other people do the dirty work and have Reagan come across as a nice guy, you know, saying, there you go again in the debate to Jimmy Carter, being affable. So I think Nancy was quite happy to do some of the dirty work in this ad.
Was this ad effective, do you know?
I think this is a very effective ad because it does a really neat trick. It starts off as a defense of her husband. It's Nancy defending her husband from attack. And then halfway through the ad, she turns it around and she goes on the attack against Jimmy Carter. And she's lecturing him. She's saying, you know, I want Jimmy Carter to answer to me. I mean, that's a pretty amazing way to talk to the president of the United States. And I think some of the best politicians, the real masters of the form, know how to sort of start off seeming nice and then go on the attack. And the whole 1980 campaign, the Reagan campaign against Carter, really had to attack Jimmy Carter as president. You know, when you have an incumbent president, you really have to convince the country that they've done a bad job or that they should be replaced. So I think this ad really, really did that trick.
David Schwartz is curator of film at the American Museum of the Moving Image and co-curator of its internet exhibition of political campaign ads, The Living Room Candidate. You can find the exhibition at livingroomcandidate.movingimage.us. Schwartz will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble. With the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Harriet Jacobs's Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the political genius of Abraham Lincoln. We talk with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin about her book Team of Rivals, which has just been awarded the 16th Annual Lincoln Prize. Also, more historic presidential campaign ads. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Schwartz, curator of film at the American Museum of the Moving Image in New York and co-curator of its internet exhibition, The Living Room Candidate. It features over 250 presidential campaign ads from every election year, beginning with 1952, when the first TV campaign ads were broadcast. You can find the exhibition at the website livingroomcandidate.movingimage.us. When we left off, we were talking about Reagan's political ads. No, the most famous political campaign of the Reagan era was the Morning in America ad, which is, I think it's fair to say, one of the more famous political ads in political ad history. This was in the 1984 re-election campaign. Again, I'm going to ask you to describe what's happening visually before we hear it.
Basically, we're seeing a montage of images. It's almost like a moving Norman Rockwell painting. We're seeing a sort of white picket fence series of shots of people in a small suburban town going about their business. It's very upbeat and positive. We don't see Ronald Reagan in the ad. And when you, if you're just watching the ad, it could be for almost anything. It could be an ad for an insurance company, a beverage, any kind of product. It's an upbeat, positive-looking idealized view of America.
Okay, let's hear it now. And this is the Morning in America ad for the Reagan campaign in 1984.
It's morning again in America. Today, more men and women will go to work than ever before in our country's history. With interest rates at about half the record highs of 1980, nearly 2,000 families today will buy new homes, more than at any time in the past 4 years. This afternoon, 6,500 young men and women will be married. And with inflation at less than half of what it was just 4 years ago, they can look forward with confidence to the future. It's morning again in America. And under the leadership of President Reagan, our country is prouder and stronger and better. Why would we ever want to return to where we were less than 4 short years ago?
It's the Reagan campaign 1984 Morning in America ad. What is your reaction to listening to that ad like 20 years after it was made?
What's interesting about looking back at these ads is that they really evoke what the campaign was all about. You know, even though these are 1 minute or 30 second ads, this Morning in America ad really encapsulates and summarizes what the Reagan presidency and the re-election campaign was all about. It was really, you know, premised on this idea of optimism, and that's what this ad evokes. I mean, what it evokes is why people like Reagan and why he won that landslide re-election.
I don't know if you'll agree with this, but just in terms of like the music and the announcer's voice, it just kind of exemplifies what middle of the road meant. That kind of soothing, non-inflected voice with that music-y music behind it. And I think now in 2004, if you see a movie or hear an audio track that's meant to parody a certain type of earlier middle-of-the-road sound, that's the kind of sound it would try to evoke.
Yeah, it's true. The ads really use sort of the tricks and tools of their time, and they can tend to look a little bit dated. So you can look back at the old ads and say, how did they get away with that technique? You know, the techniques become kind of transparent over time, but they work. And, you know, you couldn't always get away with the Morning in America kind of ad, but it just happened to work at this time in 1984. The country had gone through the traumas of Vietnam and Watergate, and the country really wanted to believe this ad. They wanted to believe it was Morning in America.
4 years after the Reagan ad that we just heard, Michael Dukakis took out an ad saying that he had it with George H.W. Bush's misleading ads. What was Dukakis reacting against?
Dukakis was reacting against a number of really strong attack ads. The 1988 campaign was very, very nasty. The Bush campaign that year was headed by Roger Ailes. And Dukakis was in very solid shape after the Democratic convention, about 17 points up in the polls. And the ads were just very, very strong. It was a classic campaign where the Republicans tried to paint the Democrat as a weak Massachusetts liberal. And there was one ad in particular that really got Dukakis upset, where he was, they used a photo opportunity where Dukakis was riding around in a tank, in a military helmet. I mean, everybody can visualize this ad, I think, because it's been replayed so many times. And the ad ridiculed the idea of Dukakis' commander-in-chief and said that he was going to cut all these important defense programs. Factually, the ad was untrue. I mean, it was making claims that were just plain not true. But it was, what was really effective was this image of Dukakis in a tank, and the idea that he would look kind of silly as commander-in-chief.
So let's listen to this 1988 Dukakis ad. And again, before we do, I'm going to ask you to describe what we would be seeing if we were, in fact, watching it.
What we're going to be seeing is an angry Michael Dukakis turning off the TV set after having watched a Bush attack ad against him. And he's in a white shirt, sort of the Harry Truman look, you know, plain speaking, tough guy, tough, angry Democrat. And he's talking directly to the camera, directly to the voter.
Okay, let's hear it in 1988.
I'm fed up with it. Never seen anything like it in 25 years of public life, George Bush's negative TV ads, distorting my record, full of lies, and he knows it. I'm on the record for the very weapon systems his ads say I'm against. I want to build a strong defense. I'm sure he wants to build a strong defense. So this isn't about defense issues. It's about dragging the truth into the gutter. And I'm not going to let them do it. This campaign is too important. The stakes are too high for every American family. The real question is, will we have a president who fights for the privileged few, or will we have a president who fights for you? George Bush wants to give the wealthiest 1% of the people in this country a new tax break worth $30,000 a year. I'm fighting for you and your family, for affordable housing and health care, for better jobs, for the best education and opportunity for our children. It's a tough fight, I know that. Uphill all the way. But I'm going to keep on fighting, because what I'm fighting for is our future.
A Michael Dukakis campaign ad in 1988. Well, this is a very literal counterattack. I mean, he's watching the TV with the ad against him. He turns it off, says to the audience, this is misleading. They're misrepresenting me. How do you think it played? Do you have any idea if it registered on the American public? I'm sure it's what a lot of candidates would like to do. You know what I mean? Who feel that they've been misrepresented by an ad.
Well, what's really interesting about this ad is that Dukakis had been criticized earlier in their campaign for not responding to attacks. He was being attacked every day by the Bush campaign, and he wasn't fighting back. And then he decided to fight back. And I think the problem with fighting back and being so direct in your response is that you can start to look defensive. You know, if you go on the air responding to every single attack, it puts you in a defensive position. And one of the real interesting things when you look at the ads from 1952 to the present is there are some very basic strategies that are used over and over again. The Republicans love to say that they're strong on military and that if you vote for the Democrat, they're going to cut our defense system and they'll be weak. And they love to say that that they're going to cut your taxes. The Democrats love to say we're going to fight for the average person. And that's what you hear in this ad.
David Schwartz is curator of film at the American Museum of the Moving Image and co-curator of its internet exhibition of presidential campaign ads, The Living Room Candidate. You can find the exhibition at livingroomcandidate.movingimage.us. Our interview was recorded in 2004 when the exhibition was launched. They'll be updating it to include ads from the 2008 presidential campaign. Coming up, how Lincoln put past rivalries behind him for the good of the country. We'll hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin. This is Fresh Air. In his campaign for president, Abraham Lincoln was opposed by three powerful men. But later, he brought these men into his cabinet. Doris Kearns Goodwin wrote about Lincoln's political genius in her book, Team of Rivals. She says in her effort to illuminate the character and career of Lincoln, she coupled the account of his life with the stories of the remarkable men who were his rivals for the 1860 Republican presidential nomination: New York Senator William H. Seward, Ohio Governor Salmon P. Chase, and Missouri's distinguished elder statesman Edward Bates. Lincoln appointed Seward Secretary of State, Chase Secretary of the Treasury, and Bates Attorney General. Doris Kearns Goodwin has just been awarded the 16th Annual Lincoln Prize for her book Team of Rivals. She won a Pulitzer for her book No Ordinary Time about Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, and has also written books about Lyndon Johnson and the Kennedys. I spoke with her about Lincoln in 2005 when Team of Rivals was published. Your book focuses on cabinet members who were his rivals, who actually wanted the nomination for president from the Republican Party. Why would he choose his rivals to be in his cabinet?
I mean, it seemed at the time an unprecedented act because people hadn't done that in previous years. And these men were not only his rivals, but they were so much better known than he was. Seward had been the governor and senator from New York. He was so much considered the possibility of being the person who would win the nomination that 10,000 people were waiting outside his home in Auburn to celebrate. The champagne had already been stocked in the local restaurants. And he thought when he was made Secretary of State that he would actually run the show and Lincoln would be just simply some sort of puppet. But in fact, Seward and he ended up becoming great friends. I think Lincoln had an internal confidence that even though these men thought they should have been president, similarly Chase of Ohio thought he should have been president, Bates of Missouri, an elder statesman, Stanton, who eventually becomes Secretary of War, had humiliated Lincoln once when they were young lawyers together, but he was able to put those past rivalries beside him, knowing that if these guys do a good job, then it will only redound to the interest of the country and obviously to his own interest as well. And it meant that he had to have much more than they realized, a sense, I think I can handle these guys. I can master them. And he did.
What do you think Lincoln did to bring together this cabinet of rivals?
Well, what he had going for him, which I think is so unusual in political life, is that he had a set of emotional strengths that today we might call emotional intelligence. So when all sorts of rivalries sprung up with these guys, and when they got hurt with one another, when they would call each other names, I mean, if we ever heard what they were calling each other then in today's parlance, liar, traitor, thief, I mean, and these things are being said in cabinet meetings, but he was somehow able to be in the center of that storm. When one of their feelings would be hurt, he'd be able to write a letter saying, if I hurt you in any way, I did not mean to do so. Forgive me for things that I might do hastily. When he was upset with somebody, he would write what he called a hot letter, where he would write it all down, and then he would put it aside until his emotions cooled down, and then write, never sent, never signed. And there was a sense about him where he was just kind and sensitive to them. If one of them was feeling he was spending too much time with another one, he would call that one aside and give him a special time to walk together or to go on a carriage ride together. So what he essentially did is what a great politician does, which is to understand that human relationships are at the core of political success. And he somehow managed these people who, as I say, oftentimes hated one another, wouldn't even go into the same room with each other after a while. It's almost unimaginable that he was able to keep this group together. But the success in keeping it together meant they also represented very different spectrums of political opinion, from very conservative to moderate to radical. And as long as he could keep that coalition together by keeping these people inside the tent, he was actually keeping those strands in the country together as well.
What was considered radical then?
Well, what was considered radical then was the idea that early on you wanted to make emancipation the central focus of the war. And then later on, even after emancipation was made the focus, the radicals were more desiring to make the South pay for having gotten us into this war in their judgment and to wreak vengeance on them, in order to be able to make sure that the old social structure would not come back in the South, whereas the conservatives were thinking that the Union was more important than emancipation. And also, at the end of the war, they wanted to make sure that the South came back in a more gentle way so that the Union would be preserved, even if it meant not punishing the leaders of the South who had been part of the Confederate cause.
And where did Lincoln stand?
Well, Lincoln stood in the middle on all these things. I mean, naturally in the middle, not because he was positioning himself in the middle. At the start of the war, he thought that the Union was the most important thing, and that emancipation, he wasn't sure, was something that he as president could do anything about, much as he might have wanted to, because it was in the Constitution protected. So he thought the most important thing was to get a constitutional amendment to eradicate it, which he eventually did. But by the middle of the war, he came to understand that as president, he would have powers as commander-in-chief when a military necessity was at issue to be able to do something about the slaves. And the slaves were being used to help the South. They were digging the trenches. They were acting as cooks. They were protecting the home front when those soldiers went off to war. And they just unbalanced, gave so much benefit to the Confederacy as opposed to the North, that he finally was able to decide legalistically that if he issued a cry for the emancipation as a military necessity, he would have that power to do it. Eventually, you'd need a constitutional amendment. So he moved toward what might have been the radical side.
What did he do to hold together this group of people within the cabinet who had such differing views about what the fate of the South should be and what emancipation should look like?
Well, I think partly what he did was to move step by step toward emancipation. Lincoln began to move toward certain steps that would allow the army, for example, if slaves came into the army camp, to take them into the camp and keep them protected from the southern slave owners. And these steps allowed him to move some of the conservative members to see, well, we did that, and it didn't produce some sort of race war, because the conservatives were always afraid if you emancipated, there'd be this incredible servile war in the South, so that it got them accustomed to the idea. And finally, however, the interesting thing is when he finally made the decision to emancipate the slaves, he called his cabinet together, and he told them, I want to tell you what I've decided, and I will listen to your comments, but I want you to know I've made this decision. I think he finally knew that if he put it up to a vote or a discussion, then it might make it harder for these people to understand that this was his decision. And the only thing he did was he accepted their thoughts on the style of it. He accepted Seward's advice that he not issue it. He was going to issue it in the summer of 1862, and the war was going very badly for the North. And Seward said he thought it would look like he was just desperate and that it wasn't an act of considered opinion. Why not wait for a victory to issue it? And Lincoln took that into consideration, agreed with Seward, and waited until the Battle of Antietam was fought and successfully resolved before he finally said he was going to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. So I guess in some ways what it meant was he listened to them as he was going along, but he finally had to decide for himself what he was going to do and then just tell the cabinet in a very forceful way, this is what I'm going to do. I'd like you to think about it, but it's my decision.
What happened to these cabinet members that you write about, the team of rivals, after Lincoln was assassinated?
Oh, it's so interesting what happens to them. I mean, first of all, Chase is one of the more interesting pieces of the story. He was one of the few cabinet members who never did accept Lincoln's primacy. So even in 1863 and 1864, he was plotting to run against Lincoln for that second nomination so that he could beat Lincoln and become the president. Lincoln knew everything he was doing. He was aware. Lincoln had incredible tentacles, so he knew what was going on. But he somehow kept him inside the tent rather than letting him go outside. And then finally Chase did resign from the office of Secretary of Treasury. He had embarrassed himself in many ways so much because it became known what he was doing against Lincoln. But then in the fall of 1864, after Lincoln had won the election, he appointed Chase to the vacancy that arose in the Supreme Court when the Chief Justice died, giving him the highest position on the Supreme Court, even though he said, I'd rather swallow a chair than do this to Chase, who he didn't like. But he knew that Chase, who was an abolitionist, would be the best protector for the rights of the newly freed slaves.
Well, William Seward, Lincoln's Secretary of State, wasn't he shot during the assassination?
I hadn't fully realized what happened to William Seward. During the assassination attempt, John Wilkes Booth really had a triple assassination in mind. He wanted to get Seward, the Secretary of State. He wanted to get Andrew Johnson, the Vice President, and, of course, Lincoln. So he took Lincoln on for himself. The person who was supposed to kill Andrew Johnson chickened out and didn't go to Johnson's hotel. But the man who was assigned to Seward went to Seward's house at Lafayette Park, and he managed to get inside. Seward had had a carriage accident about a week and a half before, and his jaw had been broken. He was up in a bed. So he pretended he was bringing medicine up to Seward. But Seward's son understood that something was wrong as he barreled up the stairs and tried to stop him. He then took the blunt end of a revolver and hit Seward's son, who was his assistant secretary of state, on the head so badly that he was in a coma for days. He then took out a knife and slashed two or three other people, came into the room, slashed Seward's entire cheek off, and just happened to miss the artery that would have killed him. And he then ran out and slashed another couple people on the way out. So it was one of these extraordinary moments in Seward's family life. And, however, he somehow managed to pull through. And, in fact, his son also came out of the coma and pulled through. And the incredibly sad thing was that his wife, Frances Seward, who was torn apart by the thought that she was losing her son and her husband, was so tense. And she wrote an article in which she said, I've never before believed in vicarious suffering, but I think somehow that my son and my husband are getting well, and I've taken their suffering onto myself. And in May, only a month or so later, she died, and no one knew quite what she had died from, and she was not an old woman. So that the Seward family was forever broken by that event. But the part I think that got to me the most emotionally was that they didn't want to tell Seward that Lincoln had been killed, knowing how close friends they were. So they kept the news from him, but finally he looked out the window, and he saw the flag at half-mast, and he turned around, he said, "I know Lincoln is dead." They tried to say, "No, no, that's not true." He said, "I know he's dead. If he were alive, he would have been the first one here to see me after my knife attack." And then great tears coursed down his cheeks, and he knew then his chief was dead.
We're talking with Doris Kearns Goodwin about her book, Team of Rivals. We'll talk more about Lincoln after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin about Abraham Lincoln, the subject of her book, Team of Rivals. A recent book about Lincoln says that he was gay or bisexual. I haven't actually read the book, so I confess. So I'm not sure which it asserts, but have you reached any conclusions about the president's sexual orientation?
Well, you know, one of the great things about the comparative perspective is when you see something like somebody claiming that Lincoln was gay, you can look at what the evidence is and look at it in relationship to all these other guys as well. For example, it is said that because he slept in a bed with his best friend Joshua Speed for 3 years, that that's one indicator of the possibility that he was gay. They also point to letters that Lincoln wrote to Speed, which were quite affectionate and full of a feeling, of intense feeling. But if those are the measures, then almost all my guys, as I sometimes call these cabinet members, would be looked at as being gay, because it was very common for men to sleep in beds together. In fact, when Lincoln was on the circuit in Illinois, they would all travel around the state together, the judge and the bailiffs and the criminals sometimes and the lawyers, and they'd stay in the same boarding houses where there weren't enough beds. So sometimes two or three lawyers would be in a bed together. And then when I looked at the affectionate letters that Lincoln wrote to Speed, his friend, they were nowhere near the intensity of some of the other letters that I found. For example, when two of his cabinet members, Chase and Stanton, were young men in their 30s, they had both lost their wives and were very lonely and became very close friends. And I found these letters that Stanton wrote to Chase at the time saying, "Since our pleasant intercourse last summer, no one has been on my mind more waking and sleeping. I dream of you at night. I can't wait to sit by the fire and hold your hand and tell you I love you." I do not think any charges were ever made or any thoughts that these other men were gay. And I think that just means that men were more free in that age to express their deep feelings for one another. There was very little friendship between men and women because women were so chaperoned, so that women and women formed very close friendship. Men and men formed close friendships. But I don't think that we can imply from that sexual contact or sexual intimacy was the end result of those letters or the sleeping in the same bed.
Now that we know so much more about depression than we used to, historians are starting to examine how, you know, depression may have affected important figures, including Lincoln. Do you have any new thoughts about what you describe as melancholy temperament and how that affected him as a leader?
I came away feeling that rather than suffering from chronic depression, that Lincoln did have a melancholy temperament from the time he was born. There's a writer named Jerry Kagan who studied children from the ages of 0 to 20 and argues if you look at them even 3 months, 6 months old, you can divide them into whether or not they have a melancholy or a sanguine kind of optimistic temperament. And clearly, I think Lincoln had that melancholy temperament. but he also had enormous resources all the way along to figure out how to get himself out of his sad moods, humor being one of them, conversation. During the Civil War, he would go to the play when he wanted to. He went to the theater 100 times during the Civil War, if not more. He would go to the battlefront when he felt sad over the loss of a battle to talk to the soldiers. He had an acute awareness, I think, of his own needs. And except for 2 depressions, which we know about, one when his first love, Anne Rutledge, died, which it's natural for somebody to fall into a depression, and secondly, there were a series of events that took place when he was in his 30s. His best friend, Joshua Speed, was leaving town. His political career had suffered a blow, and he had broken his engagement to Mary Todd Lincoln. And he really did feel overwhelmed then by depression. And we have letters that he wrote saying that he was the most miserable man on earth, and that if everybody felt like he did, there would not be one cheerful face on earth. And he actually was so frightening to his friends that they removed all razors and scissors from his room, fearing that he might take his life. But his best friend, Joshua Speed, came to his side and said, "Lincoln, if you do not rally, you will die." And he said, "I would just as soon die now, but I haven't done anything yet to be remembered by." He had this dream from the time he was young that he was so fearful of just dying and turning to dust that somehow if he could accomplish something great, this is the way the Greeks used to think, your name would be remembered after you die. And that powered him through the early losses of his childhood. It powered him through his early days in the state legislature, and it helped get him out of this depression. And the great thing is that many years later, when he finally signed the Emancipation Proclamation, Joshua Speed came to see him, and he said, "Well, Speed, remember that conversation we had when I was in my depths? Well, maybe at last my fondest wish has been realized. I will be remembered after I die."
Well, Doris Kearns Goodwin, thank you very much for talking with us.
You are so welcome. It's a great pleasure to talk to you again.
Doris Kearns Goodwin recorded in 2005 after the publication of her book, Team of Rivals. It was just awarded the 16th annual Lincoln Prize. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From Samuel Goldwyn Films, presenting Amazing Grace, based on the true story and song behind the abolition of the British slave trade, opens February 23rd. And from hotels.com, with virtual tours, customer reviews, and over 70,000 properties to choose from, online or at 800-3-HOTELS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, it's Mardi Gras Day, and we talk with trumpeter Irvin Mayfield, New Orleans' official cultural ambassador and leader of the New Orleans Jazz Orchestra. His father, Irvin Mayfield Sr., died in the flood after the levees broke. Join us for the next Fresh Air.